I'm Peter Ford. I grew up in Cheshire. I joined the Foreign Office when I was 21. Had a career mostly in the Middle East. I learned Arabic. I was ambassador first in Bahrain, and secondly, my last job in the Foreign Service in Syria. After that, I joined the United Nations and did refugee work for 8 years before I retired 5 years ago, and now I live on the outskirts of Manchester.
Peter, when you were in Syria, what were the big burning issues? What years are we talking about, and what was going on?
It was 2000 to 2003, and the big issue was the invasion of Iraq. And this is when things started to go sour in the relationship between Bashar al-Assad, the president, who'd been having tea with the queen, literally, a month before I took up my post. The Americans were threatening to virtually march on Damascus after they'd secured the fall of Baghdad. It was They were boasting that Syria was going to be next for overthrow of regime, and naturally the Syrians responded by trying to keep the Americans bogged down in Iraq. They allowed rebel fighters to cross the Syrian border into Iraq to fight the Americans. So that didn't please the Americans or London, and the relationship then deteriorated.
What about President Assad and his wife Asma? I'm pretty sure they've got some pretty close connections to Britain, haven't they?
Indeed, Bashar studied to be an eye doctor in London, and during his studies he met Asma, who's the son of a Harley, sorry, the daughter of a Syrian origin Harley Street surgeon. And she was a trainee banker herself. If you met her, you might even think she was English. She even looks like the traditional English rose, and she has a completely English accent.
So, how come somebody who, a couple who are so connected with London, having tea with the Queen, how come it fell so sour? What do you think was really behind what was going on there?
We turned our back on them, largely because of Iraq. London naively thought that Syria should just bend over and wait for a regime change at the hands of the Americans. And the Syrians were a bit naughty. They allowed in these foreign fighters into Iraq, but it was an act of self-preservation. And what had been a developing relationship quickly soured. And within a few years, London was actively conspiring for the overthrow of the Assad regime, and was partly behind the eruption of all the trouble of the last decade in Syria by building up jihadi forces.
Now, a lot of people have accused the West of actually playing a big role in the build-up of jihadis. I know through the Americans' Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan, they were certainly supporting the Mujahideen. And a lot of people say there was black money behind funding these Islamists as actual terrorists, almost a kind of roving forces going around the Middle East and the Near East, etc. There's all sorts of places they've been popping up, including Bosnia, for example. What do you make of those theories?
Yes, that's absolutely true, Tony. The program was only the U.S. program of developing jihadi forces was only brought to an end in 2017 by Trump. The much maligned President Trump didn't really think America should be interfering. Should get the hell out of the Middle East, and so he stopped the direct assistance. The Americans had been training jihadis, knowing what they were, but secretly, covertly, from a base in Jordan and other bases in Turkey, building up forces that were known to be associates of Al-Qaeda and later on associates of ISIS. And to some extent, that still goes on covertly to this day.
What was this like for you then in Damascus as ambassador? Some of the changes going on, the sort of plates shifting around you, must have been a bit uncomfortable.
It was, but remember, I left in 2006 before things got really hot. They didn't get really hot until 2011, 2012. But there was certainly an awkwardness over Iraq and then later on over Lebanon, where Western forces conspired to make problems for Syria. But I always found the Syrian leadership very amenable, despite the tensions with London. I always tried to explain the viewpoint, the standpoint of the Syrians to London, but I could never make much headway when London takes against a country. There's not much to be done.
Well, I'm thinking more of relationships with the Foreign Office, relationships with your bosses. That must have potentially been quite awkward as well.
It was. What I was reporting back was not welcome to the ears of the Panjandrums in London. And it was made known to me that I didn't have much of a career left in the Foreign Office if I went on that way. So I chose to jump ship early. I was 58 when I luckily landed a job with the UN. So I left before the retirement age of 60 in the Foreign Office. Yes, they can be pretty nasty with anybody who doesn't toe the line.
Yeah, I think there's quite a few people in Britain are surprised about the amount of intervention, since the end of empire that we've still been trying to maintain in the Middle East, and also, of course, with the American pressure, too. So I wonder, what sort of training do you get for that kind of job? You're right in the middle there of an enormous international conflict and very controversial, too. So how do you get trained up to do that sort of work, and in protocols, all that sort of thing?
Well, you're not actually trained as such in regime overthrow. You pick it up as you go along. Remember, there'd been an earlier sort of dry run for this when Saddam invaded Kuwait in the 1990s, actually I rather supported the counterattack to liberate Kuwait. I was rather in favor of that, but so was the government of Syria. They actually chipped in. They were on our side in that earlier conflict with Iraq. But as a diplomat, you're meant to be. Adaptability is a much sought after quality. That can mean having an easy conscience. And I'd struggled for years over the Palestine issue. I was a rebel on that issue as well. Had a lot of conflict inside the Foreign Office. That was another reason they nudged me out.
Now, look, I'm imagining that at the time things were going on, you're thinking, crikey, I don't really agree with this. I'm not sure I even understand it. I wonder, with hindsight now, what have you made of the big power plays going on in the Middle East, really, I suppose, since the 70s?
Well, I tried from within the machine to make a difference. I failed utterly, but I squared my conscience that way. I felt I was making a sincere effort at some risk to my career progression. I wasn't compromising my principles, and I left before things got too difficult conscience-wise.
But I'm trying to get at is, what's it all about? Is it some sort of geopolitical power game, like a sort of game of risk going on? Or is it just about oil, something as simple as that?
Oil is certainly a big part of it, but Russia is a very big part as well. It's impossible to exaggerate the hostility that London feel towards Russia. The British establishment detests Russia going back to the days of the Bolsheviks. I think the British establishment is terrified of Russia to this day. Russophobia, it absolutely permeates the British establishment. And the hostility towards Syria, which was close to Russia, it can be explained largely in terms of this Russophobia. I mean, Boris Johnson is absolutely obsessed with Russia, and he's by no means alone. I think we obsess more about Russia than even the Americans. For the Americans, only power, the exercise of power matters, but we have a deep, visceral hatred of Russia.
Well, I know the Russians have got their naval base, I think it's called Tartus, very important for them to make sure they can keep a presence in the Mediterranean, so they're not kind of boxed in the Black Sea. So is this Russophobia really just about the Russian unwillingness to give up this base?
No, the base was only a small part of it. It's just that Russia had the impertinence to want to have some sway in the Middle East, wanted to have one country, just one country, Syria, that wasn't under the thumb of the Western powers, because we've got all the other bases covered. Syria is absolutely surrounded. There is not a country in the Middle East except Syria, and of course Iran, but among Arab countries, not a country which is able to say no to America. And we could not tolerate not having the full monopoly board. Russia could not be allowed to have one country where it had more say than ourselves.
So have the Russians, do you think, successfully blocked that move, you know, pretty much indefinitely now?
Well, the Russians have played their hand very cleverly. They're much smarter than we are. They think in much more strategic terms. Their language is always more polite than ours, but they're more calculating, and they know where their own real interests lie. We just have prejudices and obsessions.
Okay, let's come a bit more up to date with the pandemic, the COVID-19. This is, there are all sorts of questions to ask you about that, but I just wonder, what's your take on it, really? Because certainly my understanding is that there's a lot of measures being taken around the world. Some have been successful. Most have been, you know, draconian in one way or another. But actually, there's not a lot of talk about some of the real successes where there haven't been such strict lockdowns, where, you know, these some countries like Sweden, Belarus, etc., have gone for herd immunity, and they're now not quite so dependent on the vaccines. We keep hearing about New Zealand, for example. I was chatting to somebody yesterday in New Zealand, and he was saying, well, we're going to be in this situation forever now. At any time, there's going to be a lockdown when we don't have any kind of basic immunity. One or two cases will cause panic here in New Zealand, and yet this is being held up as a great example here in the West. So anyway, what do you make about, first of all, I suppose, the virus itself, and then secondly, the way that we've reacted to it here in the UK?
Well, I'm utterly opposed to lockdown. I think as a strategy, it's absolutely disproportionate, and it doesn't even work. I was tempted to describe myself as a lockdown skeptic, but in my case, it's a lot deeper than skepticism. It's outright opposition. I have been on demonstrations, on marches in London, Liverpool, Manchester. I have fought the good fight on this issue, risking arrest several times, and still campaigning very vigorously. I'm utterly opposed to lockdown. I think the curtailment of our liberties is absolutely shocking. Even Mao Zedong would have been shocked by how far we've gone controlling even intimate family behavior, that you need the permission of a policeman to go 2 miles down the road and have a coffee. Unbelievable and unforgivable. Unforgivable. I'm particularly struck by the obsession of our masters with so-called models. They don't want to look at the real world, as you mentioned, the examples of Sweden, Florida, South Dakota, Belarusia, several countries in the developing world, including Syria. Almost everywhere has done better than us. We've had the most strict lockdown, and we've suffered most in terms of fatalities and in terms of the dreadful damage to our economies and jobs.
Yes, but you can't have both, Peter. If you're going to lock down, you're going to have less fatalities, surely. I mean, if they'd have opened things up,
no,
there would be even more deaths.
No, I don't accept that at all, Tony. Lockdown, there is no proof that if you lock down hard, you will have fewer fatalities. That is simply not the experience of Sweden in particular.
Well, what about China? I mean, people argue China is one of the best performers.
Are you naive enough to believe any of the figures that come out of China? I don't. They're literally incredible.
So what do you think? Is there anyone you point to was a good example? I mean, given I don't think that many people would argue that Boris has made a hash of it, but anywhere you point out as really, a positive place?
Well, we had a good strategy going into it. There had been preparations made, and the initial strategy was to allow herd immunity to develop, not to panic. Accept that there were going to be a number of fatalities, but that it was really that we had to be cruel to be kind. And this was the standard operating procedure in world history with all previous pandemics. This has been the first time in the history of the world that the well, the healthy, have been incarcerated rather than protection given just to the unwell and the sick. That is what we should have done, but we panicked. The politicians panicked, and then the health panjandrums took over control.
So, I mean, can you give us any insight into how something like that can happen, how policy can be being made by people who are either doing it wrong or incompetently or for surreptitious reasons?
Well, one thing I learned in the Foreign Office was how to dress up a stupid policy as being in the national interest. There was a special skill involved in how to kid yourself, invent a justification for a self-defeating policy of which we had a number in the Middle East, and the invasion of Iraq was perhaps the most outstanding example. Iraq was absolutely no threat to this country. We hyped up that threat, We had, remember, the dodgy dossier, which is so reminiscent of a lot of the Downing Street briefings that we've had. So many parallels with the stupidity, stubbornness, the use of false intelligence that we now call, in this case, the science. It's like the WMD. We invented these mythical WMD. We said we were sure that they were there. And of course, it was all nonsense.
Yes, but the virus was there, Peter, and it looks as if it's killed something like 50,000 people, even at a lowest.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I wouldn't like to put a figure on it because none of the figures can be believed. But yes, certainly there has been a severe virus which has very badly affected the elderly, the infirm, the people with comorbidities. But for the vast majority of people, it's not been any worse than ordinary flu.
What's the agenda then?
I wouldn't really talk in terms of an agenda in the sense that there was a malign central intelligence involved. I believe more in the cock-up theory of history. I think there's been a convergence of interests, like the commercial interests of Big Pharma and the vaccine producers and the PPE producers. The naked opportunism and fear of being called to account on the part of the politicians who've cloaked themselves with the mantle of the so-called science. And then there's been the media where alarmism sells. The media hold a very big responsibility for what has happened. And these three forces, I think, oh, and then, of course, the false prophets, the self-regarding health bureaucrats, the people enjoying their 15 minutes of fame and the power that they're wielding. I mean, look at Jonathan Van Tam. What a ridiculous pantomime figure he makes, obviously enjoying it so much, ordering us about, telling us what to do. So there's been a convergence of interests, I think, rather than a guiding central intelligence. It's worse than if there was a central guiding intelligence, it might have been easier to counter. But because the stupidity has been on so many levels and from so many sources, it's been very difficult to fight back.
What about this? A lot of people pointing towards the amount of money being made, not just from selling these vaccines, but getting people into the idea that they may have to have a COVID vaccine every year. I mean, this is a succession of vaccines into the indefinite future. I mean, there's surely a financial interest there.
Don't get me wrong on vaccines. Back in March, I was actually quite keen to get vaccinated. I had personal health issues that inclined me that way. But the more I studied the issue and I learned about the vaccines and I saw how this raft of current vaccines were coming forward, the process being rushed, the more alarmed I became. So that now I've refused to have it, even though I'm old enough to qualify. I wouldn't dream of having it. And we're seeing just this very day that other countries seem to be waking up to the need for more care. Denmark, Iceland, and Norway have suspended the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine. The whole process has been rushed. There have been no animal studies. There have been no studies on the over 80s. There have been no studies of long-term effects. How could there be when the whole process has been rushed through in 6 months?
So you're saying you think we should just open up and just have a normal Easter and the normal rest of the year?
Well, I'm selfishly quite happy for other people to be guinea pigs. This seems to be the only way we're ever going to get out of lockdown. The government have nailed their colours so firmly to the mast of vaccines that they are doomed to succeed, whether they're rubbish or not, whether they're killing more people than they save. The government are going to say that they're a huge success story, and this is literally the only escape route from lockdown. So I'm happy that millions of people are sacrificing themselves. The more the better. But I just hope that none of those near and dear to me will risk it.
Well, look, as a former flag waver for Her Majesty's Diplomatic Service, I'm not sure how vigorously you waved that Union Jack. But I wonder how what you think is going on with the royal family, and to what extent the interview with Meghan Markle on US TV and over here this week has actually damaged the monarchy, or is it a bit of a damp squib? What do you make of it anyway?
Well, actually, I'm an anti-monarchist. I'm a Republican. I would ditch the monarchy tomorrow. And on this narrow issue, I'm with Harry and Meghan. But what I find, it's a bit pathetic. It's all on the level of a soap opera. But it's interesting because what it tells us about the nation, what it tells us about our psychology and our pathology, that we should be so obsessed with the royalty and the petty rivalries, jealousies, he said, she said. What it tells us about ourselves as a nation, and what it tells us is that we are sheep. Sound familiar in the virus context? We are conformists. We love our masters. We only want to be guided by our masters. We're always ready to do their bidding. We're interested in who they're bedding at the gossip level. But we're instinctively feudal serfs, tugging our forelock to our sovereign masters, whether they are princes and princesses, queens and regents, or whether they are ministers and health panjandrums. We're conformists much more than any other European country. This has been one of the big lessons of the last year and a half, that we have taken to lockdown like ducks to water. We are in our conformist element. And that is precisely why we will never wake up on the subject of royalty either.
Well, if you talk to, quite a lot of military people, they will say, and you can see why, that they would much rather be loyal to the royal family than they would to any kind of elected politician. They just seem to be much more reliable, more modest, more professional than the politicians, who seem, to most of us, to be professional liars.
Well, that's rubbish, isn't it? The royals are not operational. They do not control the armed forces. They are just nominal heads. Any military officer who thinks he's serving the Queen is an idiot. They're serving the Ministry of the Secretary of State for Defence. They're serving Boris Johnson. If Boris Johnson orders them to go bomb a country, are they serving the Queen? Come on. They're being boneheaded military. But it's a useful illusion. It's a useful illusion when they have to do terrible things like invade Iraq, to think that they're doing it in the name of the Queen rather than from the politicians for whom they really are doing it.
So what do you think is going to be the effect of this Harry Meghan interview on the royal family? Are their days numbered?
I don't care. But my prediction is that nothing will change. Nothing will change. It's a soap opera. We love this drama. We love the drama queens. This is we love it to bits. And the more of the drama we have, the more likely it is to survive. When the monarchy becomes boring, that would be the time to worry. But these petty dramas only serve to entrench our obsession with the monarchy.
I mean, but in the United States, a lot of people have pointed to that and say, well, it's a kind of dynastic leadership over there. You know, you had the Kennedys, the Bushes, the Clintons. You know, it's a similar kind of system. It's just it's window dressing, really, having that sort of elected president.
Well, the Americans have an alternative royalty. It's called Hollywood. And Meghan kind of straddles the two rather interestingly. They have their Hollywood princesses and princes, and the Americans obsess about them just as we do about about royalty. But the Americans got rid of the British royalty 2.5 centuries ago. They've not been anxious to reinvent that institution. Though, as you mentioned, they do love their dynasties as well, their political dynasties, the Kennedys, the Clintons, the Rockefellers, etc. So, yeah, they also have a sort of instinct for it, but they've not brought back a monarchy.
What about the central allegation, really, in the Oprah Winfrey interview, which is related to racism and the idea that a young prince is not going to be called a prince? Would he actually get the chance to be called a prince? We don't know. And the idea that maybe it was going to be determined on his skin colour, that was the allegation anyway. Do you think that holds any water?
I think it's rather pathetic that anyone should be so attached to having their offspring be a prince. If Harry had any guts, he would have given up his title and become a Republican. That would have been interesting. But he's a nice chap. I like the way he came over in the interview, I must say. But I don't have much time for any of them. But that said, if you're going to have princes and princesses, then it's not fair that one should be excluded because they might be coffee colour.
But, I mean, are the royal family racists, Peter?
I've no idea. I haven't. I had actually met members of the royal family, but I've not discussed race with them. I got descended on by Prince Andrew when I was ambassador. That was a dreadful experience. You wouldn't want to be descended on by Andrew, and even worse, the courtiers, the staff. They are dreadful, snobbish, bossy, unbelievable, and living in not just in the last century, but 3 centuries ago in their attitudes. It wouldn't surprise me in the least that the courtiers were really racist.
What was it like being descended on by Andrew then? What happened?
Well, at the time, Andrew was supposed to be promoting British exports. So he came with a delegation of business people, and he was just so patronizing. He literally at one point patted me on the head. unbelievable. I'm not a big fan. You probably sense that.
Okay, well, anyway, there's some big changes over in the States, allegedly. I mean, one does wonder, really, whether a change of president really means much of a change of policy. Sometimes it seems it doesn't. But what do you make of the new Biden administration? Do you think there'll be any changes internationally? I mean, obviously, the US, most of the American citizens will be voting on domestic policies, but the whole world is watching. What is this creature going to do next, America?
Well, American policy never changes much. Trump, bless his soul, tried very hard to change it. He ordered the withdrawal of Syria, of American forces from Syria, and twice he was countermanded by the real powers that be in America, the arms industry, the Pentagon, the security honchos, the diplomatic panjandrums, the Washington establishment, the Beltway, or the Blob, as some call it. And the Blob will continue to call the shots on American policy. Biden doesn't strike me as having the fiber of a man or the brain of a man who is going to shake things up. So it might, the branding will be a bit different. We'll hear more about human rights and all that nonsense, but there'll be no important changes of policy.
It's the 10th anniversary also of the beginning of the Syrian civil war. I wonder if you could say something about how you think that really started, if it really was a genuine civil war, whether there was outside interference, and how things have transpired a decade on.
It was planned beforehand by an unholy alliance of the Western powers that had been preparing from Jordan south to the south, preparing jihadi forces, and on the other side you had the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been active in Syria for many years and which was just waiting for an opportune moment, which came along with the Arab Spring, and they saw how the Western powers had overcome Gaddafi, and so the people, the jihadi people in Syria, thought it was an opportune time. They got some civilians to start a demonstration. The Syrian security forces overreacted a bit, and that was then lighting the blue touch paper. Then you got the agent provocateur, the snipers firing into a crowd, and the whole thing just took off like gunpowder.
What about today? Where are we now?
The situation's stagnant. There's a military standoff. Assad controls 70% of the country. There are only two big pockets in the north and northeast that are not under Assad's control. One is under the control of Al-Qaeda, effectively, Idlib, supported by the West. And the other is actually occupied by American forces acting in cahoots with some Kurdish militia forces. And unfortunately, that area happens to be where Syria's oil is and where most of its grain is. So they're depriving the rest of Syria of very important resources, and along with sanctions, that is causing very, very severe hardship in Syria. It's very hard to see how this logjam can be broken. There's a military stalemate, and I would predict that it's going to look much, much the same in a year's time.
It's not the first time this sort of thing has happened in the Middle East. We seem to be seeing a kind of Balkanization going on. In fact, this has been happening over many, many, you know, probably at least a century or more, that these borders are being redrawn. So do you think these new borders are stalemate? Will eventually form borders of new nations of some sort?
Well, there's a very definite risk of that. I'm reminded of Cyprus, where the Turks have been in effective control of northern Cyprus since about 1975, and that's supposed to be temporary. But the Turks, the same Turks, are in control of Idlib and a sliver of territory along that northern border of Syria. So that, and putting down roots, introducing Turkish currency, post offices, schools. So yeah, we're seeing the de facto partitioning of Syria. And with the Americans controlling the northeast, it's not a good prospect.
Well, look, I mean, I'm sure the Turks would say it is a good prospect. They look back to over 100 years ago when this region was part of the Ottoman Empire, controlled from Istanbul.
That's right. In fact, all the countries in the present-day Middle East are artificial, the result of a carve-up when the Ottoman Empire collapsed in 1918. And we and the French, and then later on the Americans, came along to carve out respective spheres of influence. And we created the country of Syria. And the country of Lebanon, the country of Iraq, the territory of Palestine. Most of it was what they called Bilad al-Sham, the country of Syria. It was all Greater Syria. But over 100 years, we've been seeing a dismemberment of Greater Syria. And what's happening today is the next and possibly final step towards the dismemberment of Syria at the hands of the great powers.
Well, this obviously benefits Turkey. Are there any other powers in the Middle East that this benefits?
Well, Iran stands in the way of this dismemberment, and this is where there's some cause for hope. Iran has done a great job fighting ISIS and helping Assad to resist regime change at the hands of the West. And Iran should not be underestimated.
What about the future? Where do you think this is heading? I know it's a bit cheeky of me to ask you to be Gypsy Rose Lee and look in your crystal ball, Peter, but whereabouts are we heading with all this? Is it just a stalemate, or because there's still a tremendous amount of tension, isn't there, between particularly Israel and Iran?
I'm relaxed about Israel and Iran. The Israelis are not so stupid as to risk attacking Iran. The Iran can still deliver massive, massive retribution if they are attacked. I mean, just 2 years ago, there was a flare-up in the Gulf that the Americans were trying to strangle Iranian oil shipments, and that provoked Iran into making an indirect attack on Saudi Arabia. Drones took out the very big oil-producing facilities in Saudi Arabia, and the Americans were forced to withdraw some of their big ships from the Gulf. What they thought were assets turned out actually to make very good targets. Those aircraft carriers are not fit for purpose in the 21st century. They are just huge floating targets. So I pin my hopes on Russia and Iran to winkle out the Americans from northeast Syria. Well,
these are the two countries which we're supposed to dislike. We've got all sanctions and goodness knows what on them, Peter.
Yes, but Biden has said that he's going to lift sanctions on Iran and return to the nuclear agreement. He started out badly on that, setting new preconditions, but there's still a fair chance that matters can be normalized with Iran And that may have positive repercussions on the Syrian situation and help to create a positive domino effect.
Well, I would ask you finally about Hong Kong, because we've seen, haven't we, this week, we've seen the latest, really, in the slow strangulation of any kind of real democracy in Hong Kong. The people, obviously, very nervous and worried there, having had a reasonable amount of, particularly freedom of expression, now being told that really this isn't going to be allowed anymore. One of the basic freedoms completely going. In the background of all this, we've got the persecution of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang as well. But the idea that there's not going to be any kind of candidates able to stand in Hong Kong haven't been vetted from Beijing now.
Well, I think we, the West, have made the situation worse for the Hong Kongers by losing no opportunity to try to create trouble for the Chinese. We have spooked the Chinese by encouraging some of the more dissident Hong Kongers and by making a big thing about the Uyghurs. We have spooked the Chinese and made the situation worse in both instances, I believe. I don't have much sympathy for the Chinese and the way they've behaved over the COVID crisis has been ghastly. What we've seen is the Chinification of Western societies. We've taken the Maoist model to the next stage. So I don't have any time for the Chinese model. But in terms of how the West has dealt with China, we've made the mistake that we regularly do by threatening and making a country which is no threat to its neighbors, by interfering where we have no rights, and ending up making the situation worse for the people inside China.
Finally, how can people follow your work, Peter? I'd be interested in people want to see what you're up to or read your stuff. And also, can you recommend us some news sites? I think most of our listeners are pretty fed up with what we're getting fed up on the London media these days.
Yes. Well, I do a regular update on Syria. You just have to Google Global Network for Syria and you'll come to it, and you just look at the resources section, Global Network for Syria. News sources, well, I can only recommend dipping into a wide variety of them, as I do myself. I've even been known to read the Daily Telegraph, Know Your Enemy. And actually, the Telegraph has been one of the more sensible sources of information about the COVID panic. There are good lockdown skeptics is, I believe, the best source of information about the great panic. Lockdown skeptics run by Toby Young, for whom I don't normally have much time, but on this subject. And it's been interesting how on this subject, there's no more left wing and right wing. There's freedom lovers and conformists. And it's actually been quite touching how we've been able to make alliance with people that we'd never normally make alliance with, but they're struggling for freedom and deserve every respect for that, in my book.
Former ambassador for Syria, Peter Ford, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tony. Anytime.